All right, welcome back, everybody. Here we are once again talking more Survivor Winners at War. Dom, only three episodes left, right?
How are we counting next week?
I say three episodes, including the one we are about to get into. So two more weeks of Survivor left. But you are right. I was indeed overlooking the fact that next week is a two-hour episode. I assume that's going to include two vote-offs. Do we know for sure? How many? Let's see.
Think that's the way it has to work, because the entire point of doing that is we need to get one more person out of the game than we have on the calendar right now. So this is the way to do it. So I would love it if they just decided to give us a two-hour episode, if only as a glimpse of what could have been if they decided to commit properly at the network. But I think that's what's happening. I think we need to get down to five, which becomes six with Edge of Extinction, and this is the only way to do it.
Exactly right. We need to go from seven down to five next week, so that at the beginning of the finale we can go back up to six and then work our way through until ultimately crowning a champion there. A lot to be getting into today, Dom, here from first thing to be getting into is putting my phone on silent. Sorry about that. A lot more to be getting into from episode 12 along the way for sure. I quickly want to get into a couple of things just from the Survivor news world. And the first one is something I feel like missed the majority of the story on. So sorry in advance for that. But hopefully, Dom, you know a little more. I have seen just kind of in passing that of these seven players currently remaining in the main game on Survivor, the commentary from social media this week was bothersome enough that four of those seven have now completely left Twitter. What's going on there?
Yes, another four bite the dust, as it turns out. I kind of feel like the best spot to be in with social media is to just be Kim Spradlin. As the best place to be in most situations is to be Kim Spradlin, but she specifically has found this great position of not really using social media enough that she could be hounded off it, and also being so perfect that no one would want to hand her off it anyway. So if you can just manage to do both of those things at the same time, you've got it covered. However, us mere mortals, and that includes a cast full of Survivor winners, are not so lucky. And so, yeah, Ben, Nick, Sarah, and Denise all quit the website, as I've taken to calling it, temporarily at least, and possibly for good this week.
Yeah, I don't know. Again, don't know really the specifics. I've heard a lot all season about many of the players along the way taking some serious heat for one reason or another that did not appear to be even remotely justified to me as it was going down. I am not really well versed on what specifically caused all of this week, but it is definitely kind of crazy to me to see over half of the players who are still alive on the show just say to themselves 2 weeks before the finale, that's all that I can take. I cannot do another week of this. And job well done by the website, Dom, I would say. Not job well done, but job done as expected by the folks on Twitter in terms of their ability to engage with the players in a positive. Not everything needs to be blatantly positive. Like, I don't think we should live in a world where everyone is just immune to ever hearing any sort of criticism, but I guess I will say story definitely checks out that Twitter has managed to run so many of the survivors on the current season off of its platform, and honestly, I'm pretty surprised this doesn't happen more often.
Yeah, it does seem to have reached a new intensity this season, and I wonder if part of that is when you have returning players, some of those players have more, I'll say it, deranged fan bases than others, and they bring those with them. And then when those players don't do as well, they vent those frustrations on the players who are doing well. So you can piece together who that might be exactly. But I think with an all-star season, that is part of what is priced into it. And it really does seem to be ramping up to a new level this season, where it seems like every season there's some controversy that should not be a controversy. It's just, you know, people just don't know how to conduct themselves on social media. So there are usually one or two casualties at least. But yeah, this season, they're dropping like flies, Colin. I've never seen anything like it.
So we have Michelle, Jeremy, and Tony left out of the players in the main game?
Yes, that sounds
right. What's the over-under on finale night for how many of those three are still around?
Tony has quit Twitter before and could certainly do so again. And the people who are handing everyone else off Twitter seem to be perfectly fine with Michelle, so I think she's safe for the time being. Could go either way with Jeremy, I suppose. You know, the internet is fickle. I can see them turning on him too.
Mm-hmm. So maybe more developing along the way with this story. And once I do want to apologize for just not knowing anything about the particulars in terms of what caused such a stir this week. But I definitely did want to note that for the historical record in case anyone missed it, because I do think that is a pretty interesting kind of subplot. The feedback, if you want to call it that, kind of rubbing so many of the cast on this like all-time great season, you know, this all-time great cast at the very least, and we can certainly get into how the season is progressing very soon. It seems to me like this should have been a time where so many of the Survivor fans were happier than ever, and it seems like we may have been going hard the opposite direction now.
It is really unfortunate, yeah, and I do wonder as well, when we don't have season 41 coming in the autumn to distract us, if any lingering after effects of that from this season are just going to carry on and fester for a long, long time.
Yeah, we may be lucky in certainly not in the global sense, but in terms of Survivor, I don't think it would be the worst thing in the world if they were not even necessarily by their own choice, but kind of forced to take a break for a little while. And I think it might be helpful for the fan community as well to have a break for a little while.
And that was the policy in place. I think I don't know how long it lasted for. I know for Natalie Anderson on her season, that was the thing, but I think they relaxed that fairly quick after that. But yeah, honestly, it may be time for a return, if only to shield those players from, you know, from that online hate. I mean, it sounds kind of patronizing or paternalistic, but it may honestly be the way to go at this point.
So that is a good point as well. I just meant, you know, Survivor 41 is not filming yet, and is obviously not good that there is this global pandemic going on that is causing that. But I just meant, I think both the show and the fan base could seriously gain a bit if we took like a year off and just kind of let the emotions simmer down a bit.
So that, yeah, that's the conclusive verdict we've reached. Pandemics, bad. Hatred, bad. You know, good things are good. I think that covers most of it fairly comprehensively.
Okay, good stuff, Dom. And the other thing I wanted to say, the first 5 or so minutes of this podcast will be free, but just so you know, Dom, and so the listeners out there know, my new going rate for conversing with anyone is $750 per 15 minutes. So I just trust you and anyone who continues listening on to this podcast to Venmo me that accordingly, right?
Absolutely. You know, I would pay every week for the privilege of talking to you, and I get to do that. I feel truly blessed.
Yeah. What I am referencing, and I had been saying to myself, all right, no one's getting anything out of me and all that I say about Rob and probably Sandra as well, Boston Rob and Sandra, over the years. And I'm ready to just put that in the past. And then this guy this week, I like just could not help myself when I saw that he posted, hey, I'm doing Zoom meetings now that everyone's trapped in quarantine and you can book me to come on your Zoom meeting. I got a text even from great friend of the podcast, Casual Anna, saying she was debating doing that until she found out the price was $750 for 15 minutes of Boston Rob's time.
Like, so my favorite subplot of this is that we have a mutual friend who in a video that his friends very kindly prepared for his birthday, Boston Rob makes an appearance in that, I believe. So now I'm wondering just how much money was spent on giving this guy a truly happy birthday.
Yeah. So if anyone is interested, hey, like, I want to be very clear, as ridiculous as I may find that price, hey, if there are people willing to pay that amount to Boston Rob, far be it from me to begrudge the guy anything for striking while the iron is hot. Like, I certainly have no issue with that.
I fully respect the hustle, but that video that I mentioned also contained, among other people, Tyson and Coach. And now Coach is the one that really is making my mind melt here, because I could see Coach charging like $2,000 for 15 minutes or like $2 because he wants the entire world to benefit from his wisdom, regardless of, you know, poverty or anything else.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure my coach lands on that. But honestly, for Rob, I feel like this is the kind of thing that circles back around on itself, where when someone starts charging like $25 for 15 minutes, that seems a little tacky. That's a little excessive. By the time you reach like 500 even, it's so absurd and excessive that it becomes funny again. And now we're fully at that stage of the cycle with Rob.
Right. I mean, Will Kirby charging $1,000 for a 2-minute cameo is funny because he knows no one's going to do that. He doesn't want to do cameos. He just wants to be the most expensive guy on Cameo. Boston Rob is looking you dead in the eye and saying this in all seriousness, that like he genuinely thinks he should get $750. And again, fully respect the hustle. And actually, along similar lines, it genuinely seems to me, between the Zoom calls and now, in case anyone missed this as well, he is selling custom Boston Rob t-shirts. There are two designs, one that says "always fight," quote attributed to Boston Rob on the front of the shirt, one that says "rule 24, never, ever, ever give up," attributed to Jimmy Valvano. Check that, attributed to Boston Rob, on the t-shirt. And I am telling you, Dom, there is just no way anyone spent more than literally 5 minutes using 1996 Microsoft Word clip art to design these shirts. These are, again, I had this conversation with Casual Anna about Boston Rob and his inclination to cash in here, and I thought she, you know, if anyone is going to just blindly defend what Boston Rob is doing, it would be Casual Anna, his number one fan. You can never do any wrong in her eyes. And she said, "Those shirts are so terrible, I'm offended that he thinks I would want that." Like, and by the way, Dom, in case you are picky, these shirts are available in 3 different colors. You can get this in orange, purple, or pink. I know the standard 3 that everyone always sees all over the place, but there you go, in terms of if you do want to go give Boston Rob some of your money just for being Boston Rob, as far as I can tell, have at it. There are multiple ways this week that you can go and do that.
I predict if anyone actually pays $750 for 15 minutes, that video is going to be like an Island of the Idol style segment of him berating them for not negotiating and haggling the price down. Like, this is a test, you know. You don't get some like personal greeting. You get Rob teaching you a valuable life lesson of how to not waste your money in the future.
Yeah, I would be very curious. And like, that's the thing is, if you had asked me, or if you just told me, all right, Boston Rob is going to do Zoom calls, how much do you think he's going to charge for 15 minutes? I'm sure my answer would be way more than it probably should be. And I think I would probably ballpark that at like, I don't know, $150, $200 for 15 minutes. Like, we are way more than tripling the high end of the high end of estimates.
I remember back before Cameo, when Ian Terry was, there was some thing where a bunch of Big Brother alumni were charging for those personalized greetings or voice messages, and we tried to work out what is the hourly and what should we have spent on all of our combined podcast appearances with Ian over the years. You know, we're racking up thousands of dollars in free airtime with Ian, and I don't think we ever got a conclusive answer, but yeah, I think the Boston Rob postseason retrospective is solidly off the table, unless all of you out there subscribe to our Patreon and really make your voices heard, and maybe that couldn't be in play again.
Well, actually, one thought that I had is I'm pretty confident that $750 per 15 minutes is less than Sandra got for the one podcast she was willing to do after the patrons Venmo'd her thousands of dollars.
Honestly, the one thing that could boost my respect for Sandra the most is exactly that. You know, I just love the hustle, and the fact that she is completely unapologetic about it just makes it even sweeter.
Oh, Queen absolutely stays queen in that respect, for sure. Dom, so there you go with your Boston Rob praise segment of the week. Sorry, I know most people do not agree that he is someone worthy of criticism, but anyway.
Well, hey, look, we're no longer a Ben Driebergen fan podcast, but we have to find someone else to stand now, and who better than Boston Rob?
It's because I was listening to Shane Powers on RHAP a couple weeks ago talking about how he's just like putting the animosity towards Jeff and the producers just behind him and feeling so much better. And I literally said to myself, like, I'm just going to stop with the Boston Rob and Sandra stuff. And here I am, like, 1 week later, opening a full 10 minutes of the show on the latest Boston Rob racket. Well, but anyway.
The thing about that is that when Shane says that he's given up being bitter and resentful and angry towards someone, you know that it's not because he's mellowed out and turned over a new leaf and his personality has changed. It's that all of that hatred is being channeled in a different direction, and you don't know where it's going to land. It really could be anybody.
Yeah, let me just reiterate one final time, because it's hysterical as I find the idea of Boston Rob charging $750 for 15 minutes. If he is finding people out there who are willing to pay that, 100% respect. Absolutely fine with me.
Oh, absolutely, for sure.
Yeah, all right. So let's get into it, Dom. Enough on Boston Rob. He's been out of the game for a little while, at least for now. I'm sure there will be more Boston Rob coming up when we get to the Edge of Extinction this week. But let's get into the main game here and the fallout after last week's blindside, where Tony hatched that plan at the very last minute to turn things around on Sophie and really betray, as far as I can tell, his closest ally to this point in the form of Sarah. And we had been wondering during last week's podcast about how Sarah would react to that. Certainly anyone who has seen Tony in Cagayan, I would imagine, is going to have some skepticism about Tony flipping just the one time, and now he's definitely back with you for sure. And I think that's pretty warranted. But particularly for someone in the form of Sarah, who was there witnessing all of that go down firsthand in Cagayan from the jury bench, I was personally, at least, surprised at how quickly it seemed like she was willing to come around and forgive Tony, at least as the TV version presented the story. What did you think about Tony eventually getting back in Sarah's good graces? It seems pretty pretty fast here.
There was a sharp intake of breath. There we go. Distracted moment.
Breath. It was a very wide scope.
Well, that too. There was a sharp intake of breath in my household when Tony swore on his kids, not only again, first of all, but to Sarah, who was there the last time he swore on his kids and was reamed comprehensively for it by a jury member. And I would not be surprised if we will see Tony being taken to task for that by a jury member, and that jury member being Sarah this time. So I think that particular chicken could come home to roost for Tony. But in a way, I think their reconciliation is a validation of Tony's move last week. And in a way, it's the fact that it validates that, it also validates Sarah's gameplay up until this point, where the idea behind Tony's move, or one of them, was to remove this parachute for Sarah, this more appealing option who, you know, so Sophie and Tony don't seem to have that much of a connection, and Sarah is super tight with Sophie, so why not lop off Sophie and free up Sarah to be your number one cop partner, partner in crime again? But it seems like Sarah still has enough other options that Tony's not, that they're not exclusive. For as much as she was fulminating to him about how he ruined her game and her game is sunk and it's all over, it seemed like in an episode where Tony was immune and enough people wanted to go after Tony, and if you can't go after Tony because he's won his third immunity in a row, why not go after his closest ally in Sarah? And yet Sarah's name, it seemed like, never even entered the conversation. And part of that was because this move against Tony was being spearheaded by Kim, and Kim still wants to work with Sarah. She still has a good connection there that she wants to leave open. She loves leaving her options open, and I guess now she doesn't have any. But it shows that Sarah is allowing herself to be that option for enough people that even when her card should be marked, no one even seems to be looking at it.
I think that is a really excellent point, and especially in a season where we have seen so many people be eliminated just by virtue of being perceived as being too close with the big threat we would actually like to see taken out. So I definitely think that is worth flagging up in terms of the conversation we had last week talking about this flip without seeing how it was going to play out. I think you make a really good point about Sarah being in a really strong position if she's able to get through this sort of thing without anyone, it seems at least. I'm sure her name came up from time to time, but at least it seems like there was no real effort within the lead up to Tribal Council to turn things around on Sarah. But another element that I think is worth touching back on from last week's podcast that was floated to me, and I wish I could give credit where it's due. It was floated to me in advance by someone who thought we were potentially being a bit critical, or overly critical, I guess, of Tony and his willingness to make the move that early. And I think this is also kind of backed up by what we see play out this week, which is I do believe we were kind of underselling Tony's ability to have an accurate read on the rest of the cast and make his decision to flip on Sophie, heavily weighing all of the possible timelines and ways that could go from every single person's perspective. And it is, I would say, in retrospect, something that I regret, not being willing to give Tony, you know, a lot of people are talking about how Tony's not getting enough credit this season, Dom. So let me come clean here. I do definitely think I was overlooking or undervaluing Tony's own ability to take that into heavy consideration when weighing whether or not this is the right time for the move. And then similarly, I've seen another point raised this week in a couple of places about it at least being possible that Tony in Cagayan was almost being undersold in terms of his ability to put out his own fires, and that Trish gets a ton of credit for getting people back into the mindset of being willing to trust Tony after he's just burned them at whatever the latest odd number was. It really does seem like Tony alone was able to win back the favor of the person I would say has been the most powerful player in the game from the merge forward, in the form of Sarah Lucina. So where are you on that? Am I reading too much into this, or looking for reasons to give Tony too much credit when it comes to damage control? Or do you feel like Sarah now is just the new Trish putting out his fires for him as soon as he's back in on her good side?
On that first point, we see Tony again this week, instead of just going with the seemingly safe option presented to him, push his chips into the middle and get rewarded. And it's easy to look at that as being unnecessarily risky, or does Tony really have the information and the read that he needs to be confident in that move? And it turns out the answer again seems to be yes. And you know, it's hard to take too much issue with it when he lays out his plan and what he's going to do and just executes it very well, even if the chaos that's inherent to that plan makes it hard to unpack exactly what's going on at any one time. And as for the Trish comparison, I think that in his first season, you in anyone's first season, you need that figure more where you are a stranger to them. And even though the caliber of player is lower, you still don't have that iron tight connection that Sarah and Tony have, being both close personal friends and three-time Survivor players on the shared on the same seasons, where they have that shared history going back over 6 years now. And you know, of all the fires that Tony could be equipped to put out, a fire with Sarah is at the top of the list. Whereas if it's a fire with, you know, Ben or Nick, he still seems to be pretty adept at doing that. We see him try to do damage control with Ben this week, and it seems to go okay. But I think there's a lot more leeway to do what he needs to do with Sarah, even though Sarah herself seems to be a lot more cutthroat than some of the other players on the season.
Yeah, I certainly remember talking about believing in whatever week it was flagged up that Tony and Sarah felt good about each other. They got separate confessionals talking about that potential partnership, and it seemed to me like they both were sincerely interested in making that a very long-term thing for as long as they could feel good about the other person. And so obviously I would imagine that this Sophie blindside gave Sarah a lot of second thoughts about Tony and how reliable he may be going forward. But it did seem like their just kind of trust that I would imagine is largely due to knowing each other for so long, both being cops and having looked forward to this opportunity to play as fellow winners on an eventual kind of legends or all-stars or all-winners kind of season for so long. Like, I do not believe that this Cops R Us thing just happened on day one on the beach. I strongly believe that this has been something they have both been wanting for a long time since Sarah became a Survivor winner herself, and I think you are totally right that it may make that that may make it the make Sarah the easiest person for Tony to get back on his side, just given all of the goodwill from all of these years. I could have seen that going hard the other direction, where Sarah certainly wouldn't, I wouldn't have been surprised at all if Sarah said, fucking forget it, I'm never going to trust you again after what you just pulled, and I would not begrudge her anything for having that kind of reaction. But what we end up seeing is her saying, all right, whatever you want to do, do it. I don't care who it happens to, as long as it's not me. But if you fuck me over, we're done forever. I'm never talking to you again. I am with you, Dom, that I could see this potentially coming back into play down the line. If Tony does indeed burn Sarah, and she could be kind of the Trish figure this season, really looking for an explanation at Final Tribal Council. What do you think about the possibility of that being the case? Where are you landing right now on the likelihood that Sarah will deeply regret giving her trust back to Tony?
Unclear if Tony is ever allowed to talk to Sarah again as of this present moment, but I guess we shall see.
She certainly can't tweet at her anymore.
Well, sure, yeah.
Are you feeling like, because to, I guess, answer my own question, I do think it is well within the realm of possibility that this is going to immensely backfire on Sarah.
Yeah, and I could see Tony getting to the end without Sarah in a way that doesn't involve Tony blindsiding her necessarily or betraying her again. Like, let's say Sarah loses at Fire or something, or maybe it's Tony versus Sarah in Fire, and that one of them has to win, one of them has to lose. But yeah, I would not be sitting pretty right now if I was Sarah, and that's kind of what Tony's anticipating too, right? Like, he's trying to cut away all of these other options, and however frustrated Sarah's going to get by that, if he is the only one left, then what's she going to do about it?
Right. I definitely think.
Okay. I was just going to say on that, worth noting here that Kim, who was maybe making a fatal mistake in leaving Sarah's name off the board here, knowing that, Kim continues to be an appealing option for Sarah. So the fact that now Kim is gone at Tony's hand, another one down, and it's unclear who is left that really feels that close bond to Sarah now.
Yeah, I guess I may have been. I still feel like Sarah is not in immediate jeopardy at the hands of anyone other than Tony, and I don't feel like that's necessarily happening this next round. Although we are running out of time, so it wouldn't surprise me at all if it is happening this next round.
Yeah, it feels like Tony needs Sarah as much as Sarah needs Tony, and that's by design. And it almost makes it easier for Sarah to trust Tony, knowing that even if Tony had some harebrained scheme to go for Sarah in the very near future, he would just be leaving himself exposed and himself in even more danger. So unless Tony is getting into his head after his challenge streak that he can just run the table, which maybe he can, but I wouldn't bank on it, then he needs Sarah at least in the short term. And she knows that, and I think he knows that she knows that. So that's at least keeping the lid on things for now.
Yeah, there are a couple other spots where Tony has to do some damage control this week as well. I'm sure we will get more into the Tony and Sarah dynamic along the way here, but I wanted to get into something that I thought was really interesting, and it actually kind of ties into something that we talked about either last week or the week before. Whenever Tony found that hidden immunity idol, we see when he's doing his damage control with Ben after he's gotten Sarah back on board, he tells Ben directly, hey, I have an idol. I did this for us. We're still good long term. And Ben in confessional talks about how it feels good that Tony's telling him about his idol and his advantages, and that builds trust. But, you know, blindsiding him on these votes does a lot to take away from that. We talked about the idea of Tony potentially feeling like it could be beneficial to have everyone in the game know he has this idol, particularly if he picks up another one along the way that he did not end up getting this week. But just the idea that it seems like Tony's idol is becoming basically public knowledge at this point, and just kind of using that information, understanding that it's going to get out to get people back on your side. What do you think about the approach he's taken there?
Well, first of all, I applaud your restraint in not going for the obvious beneficial pun.
Yeah.
Yes, thank you. But we mentioned that it may help Tony for this information to be out in the open, but if he just goes around telling people or threatening people that he has an idol and could use it at any time, then it maybe comes across as too aggressive or too, like, classic Tony-esque in a way that will put people off. So the fact that he can reveal that information in a way that seems like he is just generally trying to build trust and repair relationships, I think it gives him the best of both worlds. Like we see with in the conversation with Sarah, he reveals that information, but her response made me think that she knew that already, and this was just like a reminder, and he was emphasizing that rather than informing her of it. But when we get ahead to later at Tribal Council, I feel like that aspect of it worked out perfectly for Tony, if this is what he's going for, where if he wants this information to be out there, or he assumes it's going to get out there anyway, so why not get ahead of that and control that flow of information? He couldn't draw it up any better, where he gets to offer two-player on Sarah. So it shows that he's willing to make a bold move of using it on someone else and to work with his trusted alliance in using it on them, which is going to maybe tempt people to Tony's side, and certainly will help keep Sarah on board. But then he doesn't actually have to use it, so he gets to keep it, and now everyone knows, which is what he wanted anyway, but he gets to shroud it as this altruistic form of gameplay, which it definitely isn't.
So one question I had, and I'd be curious to hear what you think about this, so I will ask you. I feel like we may be at the point where an idol just kind of feels different than not necessarily even a mystery advantage, but just any kind of abnormal thing that there's probably only going to be one of over the course of the season. It feels to me like players are generally going to be really nervous about the advantages, whereas an idol, I feel like, has become so ubiquitous within the Survivor world that people fully understand how it works, how to potentially play around it, and it could at least conceivably be less threatening, even if more powerful than like a steal a vote or an extra vote or the 50-50 coin. It's obviously more powerful than the 50-50 coin because it works 100% of the time that you play it. But I remember for sure when Sarah and Jeremy were having their back and forth a couple of weeks ago trying to figure out who was going to play their mystery advantage first, I was very adamant at the time that, you know, as soon as the group knows that you have this thing, even if it's not going to do your side any good tonight, I would be a fan of just burning it to get that target off of your back. And so I just wanted to flag up what I believe is a pretty noteworthy difference between how people in the main game may react to an idol versus pretty much any other sort of advantage, and why I'm much more okay with idols being public knowledge than I am about advantages where people say to themselves, it could be literally anything.
Yeah, it's worth noting too that, especially with the way the season has played out, where we had this massacre of the old scholars early on, and now everyone left in the game has played on a recent or semi-recent season, we don't get anything like we had in Heroes vs. Villains, where Colby just seemed mystified by the very concept of a hidden immunity idol, and Rob was saying that he's really having to adjust to this new twist and dilemma in the game. Everyone here, I mean, most of them have either found idols or played idols on their season or had one played on them successfully at a crucial moment, or they've been in the arena when an idol has been in play. So this isn't a new concept to any one of them, whereas if there's some one-off twist which is only going to pop up every now and then, that's so much harder to account for, and yeah, especially when you don't even know it's in the game, whereas you can count on an idol being out there even if you don't know if it's been found or who might have found it yet.
Mm-hmm. I definitely do agree with you that the people who have played in the like advantage era are probably going to be a lot more comfortable navigating that kind of environment than someone who played like Yule or Ethan or someone who hadn't played in forever, and the game was completely different back in the day. But at the same time, and this is something I've been wanting to say for a really long time at this point, and I'm not sure if I have on any of the podcasts lately, but I almost like, I don't resent is certainly the wrong word, but like it at least bothers me how old school and new school are being thrown around as concepts within the grander Survivor discussion. Like, as far as I have ever been concerned, old school style versus new school style has virtually nothing to do with what season you made your first appearance on. It is entirely, for me, about the approach that you take within the game. And the old school is, I'm going to get my group, I'm going to stick with it, and that's going to be that. And the new school is, hey, I recognize that my opponents are game literate thinking adults, and I'm going to play with that in mind. And to me, there have been so many people that I would describe as new school thinkers. Like, Stephen Fishback played in 2009, but I think he is decidedly a new school thinker when it comes to viewing the game of Survivor. And Brandon Hance played years after that, but he is the oldest school thinker imaginable when it comes to Survivor.
Your boy Ken McNichol, I think, would be a perfect example.
Yeah.
But back when we started doing this in 2011, you know, Stephen Fishback was new school regardless, because that's just how recent the season was, right? Like, that, you know, I think the passage of time does need to enter the definition in some way. But yeah, it's just so weird to think, like, is Tyson an old school player when, you know, he played on Steven's season back in 2009, and then again, so on and so forth. But, you know, but Boston Rob maybe is the most extreme example possible, right? Where you go all the way back to season four. Does that just by default make him an old school player, or just does having the experience of being in a new school game, and in Rob's case winning a new school-ish kind of game, does that elevate you to new school? Like, how do you earn those stripes?
Well, this is not an answer to the question you just asked me, but I have felt for a while, like, setting aside, and I'm sure this is a much more important priority for the people at CBS, but, like, I'm sure Boston Rob is a huge audience draw, and upping him is a great move in terms of the casual Survivor fan becoming more invested in the franchise. But I have thought, and will think forever, I assume, that the pedestal upon which the Boston Rob Redemption Island game and that just style of play has been put has been extraordinarily detrimental to the public understanding of how Survivor really is as a game. That is an approach that works only when you run into complete morons.
Yeah.
And you know, not that I say complete morons, meaning only in the understanding of the game Survivor sense. I'm saying nothing about them as people. I just mean purely in the terms yes. of being competitive in a game of Survivor.
You mean it entirely with love?
It's not that.
Okay, well, I'm sorry.
I want to be clear. I'm not dismissing them at all out in the real world. It is just when it comes to Survivor, the Boston Rob and generally the old school approach relies on other people just not understanding. They're like not being there to win.
You want to be clear, you don't mean it with love. They could still be idiots out in the real world, and we don't give them any credit for that, but that's not what we're saying.
I'm, you know, as someone who spends a lot of time at poker players and sees a lot of questionable poker play, I always feel it is important to bear in mind that, like, everyone's a fish at something, and I'm sure many of the people that I think of as absolute garbage at poker are extraordinarily smart and successful in the fields that they actually are participating in.
It's not just everyone is a fish or something. Everyone is a fish at like 99% of
exactly.
Right. And for most of us, the best we can hope to do is to just find the few things that we're good at and cling to those with dear life and hope those faculties don't disappear before it's, you know, disappear too early. But outside of, like, when we spoke about the Barkley Marathon documentary, and I would highly recommend going back and watching that, by the way, still one of my favorite documentaries that we've covered in an episode on here. But you have these people who they're ultra runners, right? They run these incredibly insane physical feats while also then going back to their day jobs as high profile academics, option traders, you know, some mentally demanding field as well, while also in many cases seeming to have just a stable relationship and family and so on, and they somehow just manage to crush every aspect of life that they turn to. And those are the exception. And I think if you ever try to hold yourself up to that benchmark, you will inevitably be disappointed. And frankly, like, this is where you find that thing that you're good at. If it's a competitive endeavor of any kind, part of where you get your edge is understanding, okay, that you are sitting across from someone, whether it's poker, sports, or of whatever sort, you will be facing people who are worse than you at that, but far better than you at most things.
Right.
Yeah, you know, certainly, you know, if you play poker for any length of time, there are people who are just crushing life. They are incredibly financially successful, if nothing else. They can afford to just blow off hundreds or thousands of dollars on a whim. And they're okay with that. And you have to be okay with them being okay with that in order to make your money in the first place.
Please understand, I am fully aware that...
Well, yes.
I am good at one card game, and that is the only skill I have in life. I get it.
I'm not trying to either neg you or mansplain your own profession. I
just want to clarify. I went on this whole kind of tangent just because... I am very nervous that when I'm speaking about Survivor, it comes across like I'm saying I'm smart and everyone else is a fucking idiot. I am totally. I would go out of my way to grant that this is not even remotely important in the real world. Like, being good at Survivor is totally incidental, and understanding anything about Survivor is essentially useless compared to any sort of real world skills.
And it gets more granular than that, too. Like, even if you're just looking at the ins and outs of Survivor, we have been mystified for years by Denise's refusal to just straight out vote out Malcolm in that final four, right? Like, if Malcolm doesn't make that own mistake and light $1 million on fire, he is probably on the season instead of one of the guys, and someone else is there to fill Denise's spot. But instead, after being beloved by... many of the fans, including us, for years, playing a great first game, she comes back in here, is doing pretty well for herself again, quite frankly, and that just never happens if, you know, that one fatal flaw actually comes to fruition there.
I mean, if the Drake tribe loses any of the first three immunity challenges, no one has thought about Sandra. Yeah. All right. Anyway, with that, I don't even remember where we were. Tony and Ben, that's the last thing I remember talking about, is Tony getting Ben back on his side, which was capped off by a random bird shitting on Tony at some point, which Tony then wonders what kind of birds are out at night, which...
As Tony put it, what bird is in the nighttime? It's a lovely, like, childlike way of phrasing it.
This is why I don't want to do Survivor. I feel like that would be absolute best case scenario for me, is just every scene I'm in is asking stupid questions like that.
Right. And what is the answer to Tony's question? What birds are in the nighttime?
At the very least, owls, although I do not know if they are indigenous to Fiji. I think bat was the popular answer, although is a bat a bird, or is a bat, what's a bat?
Well, you will be surprised to learn, Colin, as soon as you Google bat bird, this is the first thing that comes up. Quote, even though they fly through the air, bats are not birds. People used to think of bats as birds without feathers. Instead, bats are mammals. In fact, bats are the only mammals that can truly fly. A few other mammals, such as the flying squirrel, appear to fly, but they actually glide through the air instead. And frankly, I need to have words with the flying squirrel. It's just marketing itself in a very misleading way.
I feel like a bat being a mammal, and also I feel similarly about, like, I understand, by the way, that mammal has a very technical definition and bats obviously fit it, as do, I feel weird though about, like, whales and dolphins being mammals. Like, to me, it's the, hey, tomatoes are actually technically a fruit. It is the animal version of that. Like, what the hell is going on if a tomato is a fruit?
Yeah, a Jaffa cake is a biscuit, apparently. You know, it's a whole mess when it comes to classifying things.
We need to rework these definitions. I will not rest until mammals have been entirely reclassified. Dumb. But with speaking of Tony and birds or mammals, we got at least our first glimpse of the spy nest this time. It seemed pretty underwhelming to me at this point, but maybe there's more to come on that front. Dom, what do you think about the spy nest so far?
Yeah, I don't have too high hopes for it, honestly, because I think it is such an essential part of Tony's brand that they would put it in there, even if liking Game Changers, it's not going to lead to anything. But I do hope that we get something out of it, that he overhears some crucial piece of information and can flip it around on somebody.
Yeah, I don't have real expectations for, like, the spy nest being a game changer going forward, although it is a possibility to me that this is something we return to. But either way, I agree that this is probably something they would be showing us, whether it ends up being successful or not, just to complete the trilogy of Tony and his various spying locations. But after Tony has his conversation with Ben and seems to be all right at getting a receptive audience there, Jeremy, a little less fortunate, I think it's the following day when he tries to have a conversation with Ben, and Ben just flat out is like, I don't want to talk to you. I don't care what you have to say. I'm not interested in listening, which on a season full of all winners was really jarring for me, Dom, in like episode 12. This is totally standard stuff that you would see any given week potentially pop up on a regular season of Survivor. But in a field this generally talented, it was really staggering for me seeing someone take this approach that Ben took.
Ben is going out of his way to prove all of those people who doubted the legitimacy of his win and his credibility on this cast. He's just doing his best to prove them right, and it is really odd to see. And to be fair, we have seen winners this season who, if you took someone who was uninitiated in Survivor history and showed them the season, the idea that those people could win would be mind-boggling. Like Adam Klein, Wendell Holland, like Nick Wilson, even still left in the game. That list is growing larger and larger, and how much of that is they genuinely did a bad job versus they are convenient people to make into villains or make into dunces week in, week out? Who knows? But stuff like this with Ben, I mean, maybe I guess there's a chance that Jeremy was just being incredibly aggravating and we're only seeing his side of the story. But based on what we do see and the way that Ben seems to have these interactions with many, many other people. Like, we saw Ben and Adam was one of the most hilarious dynamics of the season. Like, the two of them were the true former couple that needed to have this awkward reunion. We saw Ben, almost endearingly on the other side of the spectrum, just being tongue-tied around Rob. Like, just Ben fitting in, going through the normal social graces just seems to be a very volatile thing for him.
Right. I think it is a perfect illustration of just what a different game Ben played to win Survivor than anyone else on this cast, I would say. I think whenever the idea of like winner rankings comes up, at least in the pre-Chris Underwood era, I was always adamant that Ben should just be not even listed, just to have an asterisk at the bottom of the list, because he was just playing a completely different game than anyone who has ever won has had to play. And I think Chris Underwood, although he seems like he could have a lot more natural ability for the regular game of Survivor, I think 100% belongs in that same discussion where, like, it is not even close to the same social political game. If you were getting through on edge of extinction and then brute forcing your way with idols and challenge wins. And yeah, I think it totally shows that Ben is out here, as far as I am concerned, and like, I am not at all trying to take away the money or the title or the experience that he had or anything like that. But like, it is impossible to ignore, as far as I am concerned, that Ben is just like totally outclassed by the other people who are on this season.
Barack Obama is the only one who can take Ben's money away. You are not in the you're not in that rarefied air. But yeah, and honestly, I like having a mix of playstyles or a mix of winning games represented on the cast. And I think because it's happened so many times, it's worth having someone like a Ben or a Mike Holloway or someone who needed to run the table in order to win, and they did. I guess I would rather have Mike here than Ben at this point.
Ben did not, by the way. Ben was gifted a fire challenge after losing.
But you get the point that I think you don't just want the everyone who is in, like the Rob and Kim and Heidek Mole. You want to have a mix, and I think it makes the game more interesting too. That said, the disparity between Ben and a lot of the other people on this cast is pretty stark.
I mean, it is. That is a scene to me where I would say to myself, like, a good Survivor player, an actively talented Survivor player, just never, ever, 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 ever would conceive of having that reaction that Ben gave.
So,
I don't want to talk to you.
So where are you on Wendell then coming out of the season?
So I think with many people, and I've been really trying over all of the years that we have been podcasting to make this point, and I was repeatedly in every preseason podcast we did flagging up the absolute certainty that several people on this season are going to look totally different than they did on the season where they got the winner edit. And I think, as is often the case on Survivor and in Life, Dom, the reality is somewhere in the middle. I think Wendell is certainly not nearly as bad at Survivor as they made him look this season, and is also certainly not nearly as good at Survivor and is socially just flawless as they made him look on Ghost Island. I think it is clearly somewhere in between. I would lean, in the case of Wendell, far more towards the side of talented Survivor player who just looked worse because of his result here, and the treatment he got on Ghost Island was much more generally indicative of his abilities, whereas with Ben, I would say the treatment he got on his winning season was just a complete facade. I think, like, for the most part at least, if you even want to call it like stellar winner treatment, I think it was almost just personal content that would make the audience root for Ben, completely setting aside anything that is happening within the game. And I would imagine this version of Ben is a lot more like what you could generally expect of him on a season of Survivor. And with everyone, literally everyone who has ever played Survivor, I don't think we have a very, I wouldn't at least not personally be comfortable saying, oh, I know exactly how this person would do in general or how they are as the person in real life. I am fully aware that this is a heavily, heavily edited TV product. It just seems to me like Ben is someone who is finally getting a more honest kind of portrayal of his actual talent for the game.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay, so there we have that with Ben and Jeremy, and it is good to see that at least by the end of the episode, they are willing to get, Ben is, I think, willing to look past whatever petty bullshit he was hung up on in this moment and put his own best interest first going forward later. But before we get to that, Dom, let's talk quickly about the Edge of Extinction this week. I know a couple of weeks ago, I think it was, I guess it was episode 4. We had that Ethan segment that lasted forever, or at least felt that way, where they were going up and down getting 20 logs. This time, Dom, it is going up and down getting 20 coconuts instead. So very different. But there is, at least this time, a competitive element where now that we have 11 people on the Edge of Extinction, only the first 6 to finish are going to get 2 fire tokens, and the other 5 are going to get nothing. So this was, I clocked it, and it actually ran shorter than I thought. This only ended up taking like 6 or 7 minutes. It felt in real time to me like much longer than that. But what did you think of this week's Edge challenge and going back and forth for the coconuts and having only a set number of people eligible to get fire tokens?
They really ran out of ideas for Edge games pretty quickly, eh? Like, it's, you know, we're only 2 seasons in, and they're already having to recycle ideas from the same season, which is, I guess, maybe bodes well for Edge not returning in the future, but maybe that's not going to stop them. Maybe it bodes even worse than we were imagining.
It may indeed. I liked the competitive angle of only X number of people are going to be able to get this, and as we saw, I think it was Danny who did essentially the entire challenge and came up with nothing because she finished 7th and only the top 6 paid out. But it still, I thought you are right that the not only just repeating essentially the same challenge we've already seen them do on Edge of Extinction earlier this year, but just having this sort of thing in place, taking up episode time, I feel like, to just watch people walk back and forth for coconuts, even though it was shorter, I think, than the log segment, really feels like we could have expedited this a lot more substantially to me.
So when Rob was after the challenge was done, just as a point of pride to show his daughters that he's not a quitter, when he was going back, clutching his bloodied elbow that was hanging off at the joint, were you moved to tears the way you were when Ciri heroically completed that challenge in Game Changers, or was this even more magnificent than that for you?
I do not feel comfortable not having any sort of insight into the extent of that injury, criticizing Boston Rob for taking time off and then wanting to go back and finishing it, because as he and Jimmy Valvano know, you never, ever, ever give up. He wrote a book about it. What I did want to weep with joy from, Dom, as things pertain to Boston Rob this week, not him going back and finishing the challenge, I could, whatever, on that, as far as that is concerned.
Take or leave it, yeah.
But when he initially slipped, actually, I guess it was before that, it was when he decided right off the bat, okay, I think I'm going to be good at this. I'm going to try to take charge and set the pace and get out at the front of the pack. To have him give a confessional talking about how he quickly came to realize that the front of the pack is probably not where you want to be. I'm going to deliberately slow down and let someone else set the pace because that's going to make my life easier overall. Dom, note the date, note the time. Boston Rob finally understands Survivor.
And on his 8th appearance, maybe he'll put some of those ideas into practice.
Yes, maybe. So we end up seeing Natalie and Sophie be the real top two here. It seemed to me like they just maintained a really solid pace the entire time, and not even the likes of Yule and Tyson and Parvati were able to keep up with them. Natalie, I don't think, came as a huge surprise to many people, and I don't think Sophie should have necessarily come as a huge surprise, but at least a moderate surprise to me that she could just maintain that same kind of Natalie Anderson pace. That's pretty incredible. Like, Natalie Anderson, I think this has been like a CrossFit coach and stuff like that. And Sophie's like in medicine. This is, these are completely different kind of backgrounds here, but they both seem to.
It sounds like Sophie is one of those people I alluded to earlier who just seems to be generally good at stuff. And as I recall, she was seriously involved in athletics in high school, maybe in college. So she has that background too. And, you know, we don't want to pigeonhole her as, well, she's a smart one, and so she can't therefore be athletic. Like, it turns out she definitely can be. And that's maybe one of the most understated things about her across her two seasons, is that we saw her winning that all-important final challenge to get rid of Ozzy and win herself. But outside of that, she hadn't acquired this reputation as challenge beast when, you know, given more time to show off that prowess, I think she certainly would have been.
Right. I think Sophie, maybe more so than anyone in this entire cast, strikes me as having that kind of Barkley Marathons mentality that we referenced earlier, where you have these mega successful ultra runners like Brett Mountie talking about what makes the Barkley appealing to him and ultra running appealing to him in the first place, when he's not off with his million doctorate degrees doing whatever highly scientific research he's doing in his day-to-day life, is the fact that this is next to impossible, that so few people have ever been able to complete this is entirely what draws me to it. And I feel like Sophie could easily be someone in that same mold.
Yeah, and there was a secret scene of her arrival at the edge where she was, you know, inconsolable. I mean, the rest of the cast did console her, and she seemed happy about it, so that is exactly the wrong word to use. Literacy, not my strong suit, as we know. But she was having a breakdown over just feeling like, you know, the whole enormity of it was hitting her at once, and she continued on that thought that we saw as she was leaving in her final words, of she thought she was a lower tier winner for so long, and she was, you know, doubting herself, which, again, when you see Sophie in, you know, formerly on social media, but just on, you know, RHAP, anywhere where she's speaking in public, she does so with a lot of confidence. And so to see that from her was kind of surprising, touching, you know, really makes you feel some kind of way. But that's, you know, seeing her just effortlessly keep up with Natalie and lap the rest of the field was, you know, Sophie's back on form, you know, she's just doing her thing.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. So good to see that. And my final note on this challenge is Adam Klein gets the Dodo treatment yet again as he's struggling to make even like one trip up and down as Wendell's running past him and doing parkour over all the rocks and whatever. This may be a surprising take based on what I have said about Adam Klein in the past and my general proclivity to root for him. Fuck Adam Klein. Good. I'm so glad that he's finally getting this treatment of looking like a clown. I think this is great. But like the, I think it's another perfect illustration of the truth being probably somewhere in the middle as things pertain to Adam Klein.
Yeah, he's another one of those guys, by the way, who, you know, went to Stanford, I'm sure is amazing at everything he puts his mind to. And so the fact that they can portray him in this kind of way is maybe not reassuring to him, but a little bit of reassurance for the rest of us.
Right.
The same way that when, like, Marcus was blindsided in Gabon, it wasn't just surprising because literally everybody thought he was going to win the season, both watching and on the cast, but also because this was the first time in his life that anything was remotely challenging, I would imagine. And so, you know, it was a rude awakening for him too. So it's always fun when the tables are turned in that respect.
Yes, exactly. I like seeing Adam on the other side. Essentially, this is entirely selfish, but I like seeing Adam treated the way I feel like I have always ended up looking after talking about Adam Klein in any conceivable context. I just get clowned on every single time, so it's great to see him finally get it.
I don't need a reminder that I'm mortal. I need a reminder that other people are mortal, just for my own self-confidence.
Well, this is something I'm sure I've talked about over the years, but like one of the biggest gripes I have with the general Survivor fan community is the just kind of like hero worship of the people who are actually on the show. Like one thing that is just never lost on me is the fact that these are heavily edited seasons where the results are going to greatly impact the way that people are shown on the screen. And every single person who has ever played Survivor is just a regular human being. These are not like gods and super humans or anything like that. These are regular people who happened to go on reality TV for a little while, and it worked out really, really, really well for some of them and really, really, really poorly for most of them, or at least many of them. And the idea of like passing serious judgment on them as human beings and like what they are capable of is a complete fool's errand. And I so deeply resent the, like I said, just hero worship of some of the people who have been more successful on Survivor. And as a final note, as I am fond of saying, Jeff Probst himself is barely famous. None of these people are even remotely famous. Boston Rob himself is not even slightly famous.
Yeah, Spencer might be the ultimate example of this, right? Where coming out of his first season, he was deified by a large segment of the fan base. You know, he was the new Survivor superhero sensation. And then he comes back and plays a flawed, but I would say strong game, which I think is in keeping with what we should have seen and expected from his playstyle and his personality and so on, a very creditable finish. And some of those same people are saying, well, this guy's a flop. He's terrible. How did this guy ever capture the imaginations of so many people? And the answer was, well, he was always somewhere in the middle. And setting yourself up, you know, putting these people on a pedestal is only setting themselves and you up for failure when they inevitably fail to meet those expectations the next time.
Totally. Yeah. And all right. Enough on that. So, Dom, let's get into briefly, probably, this new hidden immunity idol that is up for grabs after Sophie left with it in her bag, or in her crotch, I think, more specifically, at the last tribal council. We see Ben and Tony off looking around together. Ben finds it as he's like mid-conversation with Tony. He's rummaging through some sort of like hole within a tree and tries to pull it out without Tony noticing. Not sure if that would have worked on anyone. Certainly not going to work on a cop who is more paranoid than anyone else in Survivor history, standing next to the guy who finds idols constantly. Tony lets Ben know, hey man, I see what's going on here. And Ben gives him the like fake fist pump, high five, hug, oh my god, we did it celebration moment. But Tony seems a little more worried about why he were trying to hide that from me in the first place, which is blatantly correct from Tony's point of view.
Yeah, Tony not the type to like be super explicit or aggressive in calling him out, but he's not gonna let him forget it, you know. He's gonna remind him of his own faux pas.
Mm-hmm. More evidence that Ben Dreebergen may not necessarily be God's gift to Survivor players, but strong stuff there from Tony. I guess if you are in that situation, the criticism I may make is, when Ben is blatantly trying to, even if you know he is obviously lying, and this is not his sincere reaction, he wanted to keep it from you, but now he is taking the line of, hey buddy, we did it. I do think it is important to let him know, I saw that, and I am nervous about the fact that you initially tried to hide that from me, but I do think it is potentially more beneficial, Dom, to play along, at least in the moment. And by the way, I have never felt more soul red than when you blatantly laid out how, because you were dead right. When I said beneficial the first time around, I had to say to myself, don't do it. Don't make the pun. Just move it along. And for you to just read me to filth for having that impulse apropos of nothing was pretty amazing earlier.
Well, thank you. Yes.
Yeah. All right. So any other thoughts on Ben and this new idol?
None in particular. I guess, what do you make of him, just to jump forward a bit, when he tips off Tony that Kim is coming for him, and then Tony talks to Nick, who then looks super wolfy himself because he fails to confess what was going on and that he knew about the plan, and then it gets back to Kim that Ben tipped off Tony, and now she sees the entire plan collapsing around her. So that one conversation really seemed to set off this chain of events where everyone just has no idea what's going on anymore.
Yeah, generally...
Well, I guess, except for Tony, who now has a great idea what's going on and can switch it up himself, but yeah, continue.
Well, I was just going to say, just kind of a loosely related thought, I was nervous that this endgame could come down to just who can get Ben Dreebergen on their side, and it may seem like that is the case.
Yeah, and it could very easily be who can get Nick Wilson on their side. You know, there are lots of darkest timelines that could manifest here.
Yeah. All right. So we will see what becomes of this idol with Ben. He is obviously one of the most prominent idol players historically, in at least in his first season. At this hour, though, I just don't feel like Ben is a huge front runner to make some kind of like major move to shape the game the direction he really wants to see it go with this idol. I suspect he is viewing this as just a get out of jail free card, much like he got time after time after time his first time.
Do you think he might feel the need to use it to make a visible move that he can claim as his own?
Like, this is like, as much as I don't respect the game Ben played the first time, and I don't have a ton of reasons that I know of to be a huge Ben Dreebergen fan in the real world, although certainly not passing any kind of major judgment in that respect conclusively. The reason I'm nervous about saying this is I feel like I really have been potentially too hard on Ben over the course of this podcast already, but the honest answer to that question is, I would think that that would be far more likely if I just had more respect for Ben as a Survivor player, but I just don't think he is I think it is very within the realm of possibility that that is exactly what happens, but at this point, I would be strongly inclined. I just hate, Dom, I just hate when people just take everything I say totally out of context. Like, I would be so, I would not be surprised at all if he uses that idol for some awesome mega move that blindsides the whole group and swings everything. But I would be strongly leaning in the direction of Ben viewing that idol as, all right, whenever I get in trouble, at least now I have this in my back pocket.
So you wouldn't be surprised by anything is what you're saying.
Okay. This is what it's hard to give opinions without opening the door for the bad faith arguers to just say the opposite.
So in the spirit of being charitable to these people, what do you think Ben imagines his own endgame to be at this point? Like what's the plan? Is it just ride to the end with Tony and Sarah? Because that feels like a surefire losing proposition. Or is it to team up with some remnants of Nick and Michelle and Denise and so on after Cops of Ross has been taken out?
So again, I could be totally wrong about this, but Ben just doesn't strike me as the kind of guy who's sitting there thinking about, like, what's the ideal final three for me? Who can I beat? Who do I need to definitely get out by what point to make sure that I have some sort of path to victory? I think Ben is very much of the Sandra school of thought this season of, I don't care who gets voted out in what order, as long as I'm not the one getting voted out. I can't win if I don't make it to day 39, and I can't make it to day 39 if I get voted out tonight. So all I want to do is not get voted out next. I feel like that is roughly where Ben is coming from.
What we do see is Nick makes this proactive attempt to get Denise and Michelle in this I won't say explicitly a final three alliance, but it sure seems like that's where it's headed, or that's what the intention is, at least. And is that makes sense for all of them, I reckon. And we see Nick say there are three people, at least, he's quick to clarify, that he doesn't think he can beat in the game, and those are Jeremy, Tony, and Sarah. And the idea that Kim would not automatically be a shoo-in for that list coming into the season would have shocked me, but I don't think he's wrong about it, actually. I think she would be a solid fourth, you know, solidly in the middle of that group.
Well, I think this will potentially give undue weight to the things we hear from the players along the way, but I do very much believe that Nick, unlike Ben, is regularly thinking about, how do I win this game? What is the combination that I can beat, and how do I make that happen? And in this kind of situation, the fact that Nick is talking about Tony and Sarah and Jeremy being the big threats that everyone seems aware of, I think almost just kind of validates by itself the idea that Kim is not being viewed that way.
And you think that she should be, or that she's doing a good job of disguising?
It is surprising to me that she is not viewed as someone in the same tier as at least Jeremy, as far as I'm concerned, in terms of endgame threat status. But I definitely do give Nick Wilson enough credit as a Survivor player to be thinking in those kinds of terms and saying things in public settings that would be consistent with what he feels the rest of the group thinks. And so the fact that that is the list he is coming up with, to me at least, and maybe this is wrong, but to me at least, suggests that that is generally the perception out there.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Go ahead.
Can I take a break for a few minutes?
Yeah, let's do it. All right, so fun little behind-the-scenes tidbit before we get into today's immunity challenge. I swear to you, this is 100% true. We just quickly paused so that Dom could take a quick break to eat some cookies. He literally dropped for cookies as we're about to talk about this immunity challenge where everyone drops for cookies.
Why have you got to expose me like that?
No, I thought it was perfect. I'm trying to compliment your commitment to synergy, I guess.
Look, all I'm saying is they're only warm and gooey for so long, but by the time you had finished nattering away, they would be deep in the cold, cold ground. So I decided I would take a quick break just to refresh myself, treat myself as to a cookie, which I very much deserve, I will say, and then be rejuvenated heading into this final stretch.
I mean, in your defense, that is totally fair. There is very little better than a cookie fresh out of the oven. So I have zero issue with it, Dom. And let's get in, I think, to this immunity challenge. It is an endurance challenge yet again. It is the hold your arm up in the air for as long as possible challenge that used to run 6 hours, but now they have not only added a perch that everyone needs to stand on, a rule is in place this season where you can't even use your other arm to help support your arm that is being raised in the air. So certainly going to take less time than it used to back in the day, but I don't imagine many people anticipated just how little time this challenge would actually end up going, Dom. Over in 15 minutes, as Jeff brings out the first temptation and everyone other than Denise and Tony ends up dropping. But let's touch on something quickly before everyone's decision to come down for the cookies and peanut butter and milk or whatever. as mentioned, Denise and Tony both winning necklaces here. Yet again, we have one necklace for the women, one necklace for the men, which is something we certainly see somewhat regularly. Generally, the first or second challenge after a merge, it is something that has come up at exactly Final Eight multiple times in the past. And on the surface, not necessarily anything to see here. However, I do feel it is fair to at least explore the possibility that this may have been a deliberate move by the producers to, in a challenge historically dominated by women, provide some sort of safety net for some of the non-women who they may want to see stay in the game longer.
I'm not saying you're right. I'm not saying you're wrong. I'm saying they're somewhere in the middle, Colin. Yeah. The right answer is always there.
Well, speaking of somewhere in the middle, another thing that was somewhere in the middle, despite everyone else's arms being fully extended, Tony's arm, and credit where it's due to Chaos Cass McQuillan for being right on top of this as it was airing in real time, Tony's arm is blatantly extended, not just at an angle. I mean, you can see over the course of this short challenge several different angles where Tony's arm is not quite 90 degrees, but it is very close to like a right angle at which he is able to hold his arm that gives him so much more leeway to move his chain and such. Like, it is such a blatant discrepancy that I genuinely can't believe the people weren't, the other contestants weren't complaining in real time about how obviously different Tony's arm was than everyone else.
Well, Michelle responded echoing Cass's tweet, but I don't know if she was like perceiving that imbalance out there in real time or if anyone else was having suspicions but maybe decided not to voice them or whatever. But yeah, it is watching it and looking back, trying to pay attention, it doesn't seem that egregious, but then when you see the still shot from another angle for a brief moment, it's like Tony's arm is just at a right angle. Like, it's just, you know, it seems like there's no exertion there whatsoever.
Right, and the angle where you can see it most clearly is the angle that the other players in the challenge would have been seeing him from. It's from the side where you can very clearly see there is an enormous bend in Tony's elbow here, and everyone else has their arm up like they're raising their hand in class to get called on.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So do want to flag that up as at least something worth mentioning on the podcast. But one way or another, Dom, Tony is going to be one of the recipients of an immunity necklace and two fire tokens here, Denise being the other, who, by the way, now 3 for 3 in challenges she has played where men and women are playing for separate necklaces. Just a fun little piece of Survivor trivia for you there. But let's get into how this ends up going so quickly this time around, where, you know, within a few minutes, several people at least are asking for food temptations and ready to come down as soon as Jeff comes out with a plate of food. Ben in particular is dying for it and can't even make it to the 15-minute mark where Jeff brings out the cookies and peanut butter that he had specifically asked for, which Jeff swears was definitely going to be the first thing they brought out anyway. So we have a couple people down before the cookies are even brought out. But when Jeff comes out with this giant platter, we see, who is it? It's Kim, Nick, Michelle, anyone else that drops at that point, leaving Tony and Denise as the last two up on the platforms as the immunity winners. A lot was made of Kim in particular, obviously, because of the way this episode is going to go for her dropping. And then as well, Nick dropping when Tony was the big target that everyone was definitely trying to take out if they had the opportunity. What are you doing? Dropping for some cookies and a fire token. Dom, what did you make of this whole sequence of events here?
Okay, so I don't know exactly how many people this applies to in this go around, but this is one of my biggest bugbears, pet peeves, consistent sources of annoyance whenever this comes up, where someone will get some minor concession in return for dropping out of the challenge, whether it's food or a fire token in Nick's case or whatever, and people on the internet will just castigate them for how could you drop out of the challenge. They just can't understand it. You see the steam coming out of their ears and it all bubbles over. And the vast majority of the time, and again, maybe that's not true here, maybe Kim or Nick or whoever actually fucked up, but I would say the vast majority of the time, someone knows, either from before the challenge even started, just looking at who their competition is, or when they're an hour, 2 hours into the challenge and they've lost all sensation in their arm and they know that they're on their way out. And if you know you're not going to win the challenge, just take what you can get. And there's, but it's such an easy thing to frame as, oh, well, if Kim, I hope Kim is willing to spend $2 million on cookies and peanut butter. Like, no, just, it's so infuriating.
Yeah. Well, no, I definitely agree with the general point there, particularly in challenges where you know you were just not going to win. Like, if this were an eat or play challenge where people got to decide ahead of time, which it may, maybe they've done this one as an eat or play challenge. Actually, probably not, with all the food temptations that come out. That's the food that I am associating with this challenge in my memory, I believe. But this sort of challenge is the exact kind of thing where I think it is totally defensible to take what you can get if it's blatantly something you are not going to be good at. And in this sort of context, I believe Kim said at some point that she stepped off and said, "Jeff, I'll take it," because she could feel her bucket was about to drop. And so she wanted to be in rather than out and not miss that opportunity that someone for it happened to someone for sure, where I want to say it was in the Micronesia iteration. Like, Jeff was there currently offering a food reward, and they just happened to fall instead of announcing that they were deliberately pulling their bucket down and did not get food. So if your bucket is about to fall as Jeff is standing there with the food, definitely speak up and say, "Yeah, I want it. I'm in," before the water dumps all over you and you get nothing. But I think the Nick consideration is a bit different. And maybe this is pure TV editing. And Tony even says, as he's like defending it later to someone in a private conversation, like, you know, Nick didn't give it to me. Nick was about to drive. He was about to fall off the thing. So he did the smart thing and said, "Hey, I want the food too." But we see early in the challenge, before the food even comes out, Tony is already complaining about how much he wants to come down. And Nick even acknowledges after stepping down, "Oh man, maybe I should have put more thought into that after, you know, Tony would be the person that would get the necklace in the event that I stepped down, and he's the guy we were all gunning for, so now maybe I screwed everything up by stepping down." I am much less willing, I think, to give Nick necessarily a pass here than I am for Kim.
So Nick has said, I think on some, like, Instagram Live or some platform that he is still on as of, Sunday of this week, that the plan was always to decide with Tony ultimately, and so he was happy for that challenge to conclude in the way it did, where, you know, okay, Tony has immunity, and so maybe people will look at other targets now, but it probably won't be him regardless of that fact. You know, he knew that the Kim group were gonna target Jeremy, and obviously he has a protection of Tony and Sarah for the time being, so he was fine letting that happen. And hopefully in the chaos of having to find a target other than Tony, who would be the obvious one, that might give his group a way to kind of break through the lines and get what they want instead.
Okay. I'm certainly not going to kill anyone for stepping down here, because you are right. This is one of the most over-berated spots in the history of Survivor, is people taking a ton of heat for making decisions in exchange for, like, food or whatever that are totally understandable if you are out there in their shoes in the moment. The other thing I wanted to just quickly touch on from this challenge is, as the first couple of people stepped off, if I were in Nick's shoes or whoever it was, Kim or Michelle, that came down second to last on the women's side, I would have been having some serious reservations about stepping off once we were down to so few people, because Jeff Probst very clearly said, in no uncertain terms whatsoever, you step down now and you eat until the challenge is over. If I were in Nick's shoes there and it was Denise has already won on the women's side and it's just me and Tony now, I would 100% be saying to myself, there's no point stepping down because I'm not going to get anything. The challenge is going to be over. And over the years, Dom, I have, as far as I have ever been heard or been concerned, I am the number one biggest advocate for give these contestants over the course of the 39 days way more food, way more comfort, give them bathing suits. It is absolutely pointless and actively detrimental to the game to make it as hard as they do on the people actually out there. In this situation, I would have had no problem with Jeff saying, that's the end of the challenge. Obviously, the food is gone.
Yeah, this is what you signed up for. You knew the rules of engagement, or so you thought, I suppose, because you're just going to get it anyway. So yeah, I don't know what prompted the change of tune on that.
But it may be the case, and again, I will open myself up to the possibility that before dropping, Nick said, if I want it, can I drop and eat? And Jeff said yes, and maybe that is what prompted Tony to say, do I get to eat too? Like, maybe Jeff did clarify before the last person dropped that you would still be able to eat even if the challenge was over right now, because they didn't anticipate this being the situation. But it is still, I believe, the case that I will generously say it was probably 60 to 90 seconds between Jeff Probst announcing you get to eat until the end of the challenge and him then immediately changing the rule.
Yeah.
Yeah. So as much of an advocate as I am for making it much, much easier in any situations where they can afford to do so on the contestants over the course of the game, this is a spot where I would have had no problem with them saying, no, obviously you don't get to eat now that the challenge is over. You should have thought of that before you dropped. Anyway, Dom, let's get into this vote here now. We see Kim quite nervous about Tony and Sarah being this very powerful duo if left both in the game, and so she at least at first is able to get Denise, Michelle, Nick, and Ben on board after the immunity challenge to vote for Jeremy. This plan is not going to stay intact for too long. We're going to see at least half of those people immediately go rat Kim out to the people that she is trying to target. But just before we dive into the specifics of this vote and how things ultimately get turned on Kim here, I did want to make what I will preface as quite possibly the single randomest call I have ever made in 20 plus seasons of podcasting about Survivor at this point. During this conversation where everyone is sitting on that bench with Kim and the whole group, they talk about now needing to switch the plan off of Tony now that he has the necklace by saying the phrase back burners. Okay, we'll put it on the back burners. Tony will go to the back burner like five or six different times. It gets subtitled, and then totally needlessly, they work in Nick talking more about the back burners again a couple of seconds later. I don't know why I feel this way. I am extraordinarily prepared to be wrong about this, but it just really felt to me like they were trying to set up back burners as like a concept to return to.
Maybe that's just the name of one of Nick's 20 different alliances.
Yeah,
this season. You know, him and Sarah are the backburners.
That's entirely within the realm of possibility. It just felt so weird to me how often the term backburner was used in that very short scene. Probably nothing will ever come of that, but I want to be on the record in case that does come in. That seemed very deliberate to me for some reason. Anyway, Dom, this plan by Kim to turn things around on Tony and Sarah by getting the vote onto Jeremy is not going to go super well for Kim here, where Michelle does not want to see Jeremy go, so she is going to give him the 50-50 coin, and then Ben also later on is going to be selling out Kim's plan to Tony and Sarah and getting Jeremy. They're at least coming together one way or another with Jeremy. I'm not going to go so far as to say they're on board together just yet, willing to vote together to make sure that this does not come in for Kim. So who knows how sincere virtually anyone was being in this moment with Kim, but one way or another, this plan is not going to stay the plan for too long. Let's start with Michelle here, who hears from Kim, and the rest of the group is at least agreeing on the surface to go along with this plan to gun for Jeremy. Michelle is not interested in that. Sounds like a bunch of malarkey to her, Dom. She is going to come up with this plan to keep her vote on Jeremy so she can appear to be in the majority still as she sees it, and give Jeremy the 50-50 coin so that he can hopefully use it to cancel those votes and stay alive in the game. Kind of the Sandra plan with the idol that she gave to Denise, except it's only going to work 50% of the time and not necessarily backfire on Michelle directly herself. What did you think of this, Dom?
Yeah, it was curious to me, and I would want to know where Michelle thought Jeremy's vote was going, and what the alternative plan was. Like, who was being idled out if Jeremy played the coin and it came up heads or whatever Jeremy called? Because there are ways this vote could have gone where the easiest way for Michelle to be in the majority and keep Jeremy is to just not vote for Jeremy and to vote for someone else. Like, if Tony and Sarah can count on Michelle's vote for Kim, then that makes their lives a lot easier. They only need one of Ben and Nick, and they don't have to put all their trust in these two very wolfy players at the same time. You only need one of them, and then you can kind of create this position where you just declare that you're voting for Kim and just kind of defy everyone else to get on board or get out of your way. But instead, Michelle kind of tries to remain in the shadows by doing kind of what Sandra did, right? Like, give your advantage to someone else, have them use that and have the vote rebound somewhere else. But then it's even less clear here than it was there, like exactly what was going on and what the intention was. I also wonder, like, even if Michelle is exposed by this vote, like she declares her allegiance and now people are questioning her loyalty and wondering what kind of game she's playing, I don't know how much that matters coming into, I guess, after this vote is going to be Final Seven, where you have Tony and Sarah as these massive threats. You have if you're successful, Jeremy stays, then he's there as maybe the target for just the fourth consecutive week. And then, you know, you have other people who, even in the worst case scenario, are probably still ahead of you on the pecking order. And if anything, that move might be what you need to really cement your advantage over your potential final three of Nick and Ben, or Nick and Denise, or I guess Denise and Ben too, just to finish that out. So I don't know. I'm mostly curious where Michelle's head was at here, because they don't really give that information to us. And otherwise it seems like, you know, it's unclear where she was really heading.
Yeah. I really don't know the initial kind of inspiration for this. It does make sense to me that Michelle could feel good about Jeremy and not want him to leave and feel like that would be a disaster for her in terms of her winning timelines. But I could also see it being the case that it is not necessarily specific to Jeremy that I'm sure she would be more inclined to do this sort of thing for someone she felt good about. But I think it is very within the realm of possibility, as I think you were kind of alluding to, the idea that Michelle may view her situation as relatively safe, if not just for the immediate time being, but maybe for the long haul, and want to definitely use that coin to do something to put herself on the map. And if she's unlikely to be vulnerable this round or the next round, and I think it expires this following round, she may never have a better opportunity to take advantage of this advantage and add to her final tribal council resume. Like, I think it is entirely possible she would only do the, not necessarily only for Jeremy, but was doing it specifically because it was Jeremy. I also think, though, it is possible she is doing this because she recognizes, I am probably going to be long for this game, and what I need to do now is give myself a shot when I am in there deep.
Yeah, that would make a lot of sense. That might be the most likely explanation, honestly. That does put it into perspective.
Yeah, I do think it is quite possible. I don't know if Ben is necessarily aware of this, but I wouldn't be super shocked if Michelle is picking up on some vibes that may exist out there that she and Ben are potentially being viewed as the people everyone wants to sit next to.
and this is her attempt to change that?
No, not necessarily her attempt at, hey, please vote me out. I don't think she's going for that. I think she's potentially saying, I'm going to be around for a while, and I may be very likely to get into Final Tribal Council, even just by like process of elimination. So I want to have some points in my favor when that happens.
The other thing that I wondered about was, it felt like Kim's side was really intent on targeting Jeremy. And I don't know how much of that was just memory, if you like, from the previous week, where I guess we targeted Jeremy before them, so we have to target him again. But it wasn't really explained last week why Jeremy suddenly became the persona non grata who had to go. Maybe it was just because they felt he had betrayed them by piecing out on Tribal Council and just leaving them to it. But it felt like Jeremy was the target because, well, Jeremy was the target. And why was Jeremy the target? Well, Jeremy was the target. So we just continue that until Jeremy isn't the target anymore. But if you're trying to line up your troops against the other side, then having Jeremy and Michelle in your corner seems like the ideal place to be, right? Like, if you're wondering where all these numbers are coming from, then if you personally have Denise and you can get Jeremy and Michelle, well, now you're in that spot I mentioned just now where you can essentially force the issue and say, here are our votes. They're going on one of, I guess Tony's off the board now, but Sarah or maybe Nick or Ben, if you're scared of an idol or something, and you dare them to do something about it. And it just felt like going for Jeremy opens up Tony picking up Jeremy's vote and using it against you, which is exactly what happened.
Uh-huh. It does. We see Tony is not thrilled about Tony and Sarah are not thrilled about this plan to be gunning for Jeremy. They feel like Kim is a bigger priority, especially with all of the influence she seems to have over these people who are viewing Tony, Sarah, and Jeremy as the big three kind of threats within the game themselves. And we do not want these hyenas coming together to devour our corpses. We want to be the ones picking them off and taking preventative measures. And you are right that it seems like it may be the case that an effort to just be cool with Jeremy, Michelle, some combination of Jeremy, Michelle, Nick, and Ben could be a lot of people's kind of ideal situation here. And in treating Jeremy the way they have over these last couple of rounds, they are almost forcing him back into the Tony and Sarah camp.
Yeah, and if the idea is that Jeremy doesn't really have anyone he can work with, he's the easy vote, well, doesn't that lower his threat level going forward? Like, going into this pivotal final seven round, it feels like having him and by extension Michelle on your side is the perfect place to be, right? Like, we could see kind of what we saw in Denise's first season, where when we got down to eight, got down to seven, it was a question of which of these pairs are gonna band together. And if Kim and Denise are a block, and then Jeremy and Michelle are a block, and then maybe under the radar there's a Denise, Nick, Michelle thing happening too, then just voting out Sarah maybe would have been an easy call here.
That's the thing. I feel like Sarah's name's got to have, it must have been floated at some point along the way there. I am giving these players enough intellectual credit to understand the possible benefits of taking Sarah out. It just to go back to what we were talking about at the beginning of the episode, it seems like there was just never enough momentum, as Tony might call it, to get any sort of plan like that in place. And people without feeling like that was potentially viable in a pretty quick way, started just throwing other names out there and were able to find more who were willing to be on board with other names. And I think that is essentially what makes someone a good Survivor player in the year 2020 is having enough people who don't actively want to see them leave, that like will go to bat for keeping them around instead of being indifferent or fine with them leaving. Like, I think that's basically the best you can hope for in the year 2020 as far as the social game is concerned.
And that's exactly what Jeremy did to such success on his winning season, right? Like, he wasn't always everybody's number one, but no one ever wanted to get Jeremy out. And so when the game just completely devolved into chaos, no, you know, it was never easy to get a vote to coalesce around Jeremy. There was always a more appealing option. And you always trusted that Jeremy, you just counted him as one of your votes implicitly. and he really thrived in that dynamic. And this season, he is squarely in the sights of everybody there, and yet it is still just scrabbling through every week somehow.
Yeah, and I do want to also say about Jeremy and why it may seem unnecessary to keep targeting him, just kind of using the same logic of, well, we were targeting him and he got through it, and now we should keep targeting him because he was the plan in the first place. I don't necessarily think that is crazy now, based on the way Survivor juries, I feel like, have reacted, particularly over the last few years, where a lot of seasons now come down to one scrappy, compelling underdog, and will they or won't they be able to survive X number of votes to make it to the end, where they will surely clean up because they were able to survive all of those tricky situations. And, like, if you are, even if it's totally unwarranted, putting Jeremy up against the wall time after time after time, and he is able to get away with, get away from that kind of, not necessarily unscathed, but certainly alive, that is almost by itself a compelling argument for him come endgame time, of just the sheer fact that, rightly or wrongly, people were targeting me and I was able to make it through. That is something juries do respond to.
Yeah, and I don't think we're going to see Jeremy face a jury again. I think his card is actually marked, but he's lasting a lot longer than it feels like anyone is expecting him to, with the level of attention he's receiving.
I agree, and I am with you that I do not see Jeremy making it all the way this time in an overwhelming number of timelines. It certainly wouldn't blow me away if Jeremy is able to make it all 39 days, but it definitely does seem like he is on many, many people's radars at this point, and the time may not be too much longer before this does end up collapsing around Jeremy. But one way or another, he is going to make it through yet another round here tonight. And I do also think it is worth touching on just how the Tony and Sarah group was able to get Jeremy and also Ben on their side to swing this against Kim. They start by going for Ben, in terms of we need to, if we want to do anything, it's going to have to be flipping Ben over and getting him on our side. And then the conversation, I think, between Ben and Jeremy leading up to Tribal Council, especially when compared to the conversation they had, or more accurately, didn't have earlier, because Ben was like totally unwilling to talk to him. I do think it is pretty incredible how quickly they were able to probably not be on the same page for too much longer, but get on the same kind of self-preservation path for at least tonight, in terms of not letting Kim and the hyenas take control of the game going forward.
Let's, for the second week in a row now, talk about Tony's timing, because once again, we see him put together this plan at the last minute, and when Jeremy knows that he's really under the gun here and something needs to change, something miraculous needs to like drop from the skies, or he's getting voted out tonight. Sure enough, there's Tony just running through the bushes with a crazy scheme that he doesn't really have any choice but to sign up to. And you know, Jeremy is reluctant, and Tony seems unsure if Jeremy's going to be on board, let alone Ben. But he knows, and Jeremy knows, that he kind of has to do it despite his reservations. So that comes together, and then with Tony talking to Jeremy at Tribal, that sets off this chain of events where now everyone's talking once again, and we get back into this discussion of whispering, which actually I see the consensus seems to be was a lot more tolerable this week than it was in the past. And I think this is a good model for how to do it, where if it's being used as a substitute for actual discussions or suspense or strategy, then that's bad. But when we get to see the actual discussions unfolding, that's great, and this is the perfect forum for that to happen, where when it's a Tribal, or sorry, when it's back at camp, it seems a little bit more distant and remote, but when it's happening there at Tribal with the jury watching and Jeff's over there, and the people that you're trying to vote out or save yourself from are only a few feet away from you, that's when the stakes feel real, and that just makes those scenes even more exciting. So Tony is mixing things up at Tribal again, and I would be curious to hear after the season, and this is the kind of thing we would love to hear in exit interviews, which we just don't have because of the edge. But I would love to hear exactly where all these votes were lined up going into tribal and how many actually changed there and then. Like, was this a live tribal or was that just an illusion? But Tony's approach of doing this last minute, it feels very much like that thing where if you want to discuss an issue with someone, like a problem, then if you don't let them know in advance, then you've been like stewing over this the whole time and you've been preparing exactly what you're going to say and what you expect to hear from them. And then if you just ambush them with that topic, then they're going to come off sounding more flustered, more defensive, confused, because they just weren't expecting to have this in-depth discussion of something there and then. And it's easy to misread into that. And that feels kind of like what Tony's doing here. He's forcing the game to happen on these terms that no one's really comfortable with. But if anyone's comfortable with it, it's Tony. And he thrives in that environment where you can't really say the same for most people. And we see this with Denise, who has really had enough. She's completely fed up of all of this. And for someone who is constantly in an environment like this, it's kind of surprising to see that from Denise. But I think that shows you just how even the people you think would be naturally suited to it can buckle under that pressure sometimes. Whereas Tony doesn't seem to. Tony seems to really enjoy and do his best work in that environment.
Yeah. And I think Tony, as someone made a good point to me, and again, I'm so sorry that I don't know whom to be crediting here. Tony spends all night, like he doesn't sleep when he's playing Survivor. He spends all night thinking through different things from other people's perspectives, and not only thinking about what is their best move, also thinking about what would be their like Tony Vlachos move. Like, how could they make some really creative move to totally flip this on its head and work this against me? And I do buy that, like, Tony is super prepared, perhaps one of the best prepared ever to implement that sort of play style, where he knows, of course, the entire premise is it is going to be chaos and confusion for most of the people around me, and they're going to feel like their hands are potentially tied. But, like, I'd be pretty surprised if too much of what has gone down over the last few weeks has come as a huge shock to Tony in terms of the reactions he got when implementing these kind of like last second plans. I think he just recognizes how much it plays into the advantage that he has over the rest of the field to take that kind of line.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. And by the way, let's take an opportunity that we don't often get to give some credit to Evil Dick Donato and Danielle in BB-8.
I'll pass. I'm good.
Genuinely, every time I rewatch BB-8, which will hopefully be coming back again soon, happening again soon, over on the Patreon feed, I don't even remember which round it is, but there is some round in like the mid game where Dick and Danielle, this father-daughter duo with insane advantage to have at any point in a Big Brother game, are both people who are voting between Jamaica and someone else. And they very deliberately spend all week making Jamaica feel like she is going to be the one who leaves and there's nothing she can do about it, with the plan of, at the last second, like right before we go to the live show on Thursday night, we will come to her with this bailout offer of, okay, we will keep you, but you're going to have to do this and this and this in every competition you win. We're going to get complete say over how that ends up going, and you need to swear to God, and you're deeply religious. And like the waiting until the last second, I think even for someone substantially less talented than Tony, is an extremely effective idea of the people who are going to be most inclined to go with whatever you say are the people who feel like they have no other choice. And I feel like that's essentially been
right
where Jeremy has been these last couple of weeks. And that's why Tony's been able to capitalize.
Yeah.
All right. So one other thing actually on the just kind of craziness of Tribal Council, Dom, I couldn't have even told you that this was a change they made this week, because all of the whispering and standing up and moving around really seems the same to me. I'm rarely even trying to track the specifics of what's being said, which I guess makes me the weird one in terms of the average Survivor fan who are like livid to not have very coherent storylines about why the vote is going the way it's going. But like with these apparently new introductions of subtitles, I think it could be a huge relief for these kind of scrambling scenes. And I want to say a couple of things about that. First of all, I truly do not care whatsoever I am borderline actively encouraging the editors to do the following. Lie to us. Make up the subtitles that will tell the story more coherently. I don't care at all. If that is the way that is going to make this more suspenseful or have a better payoff or whatever, I have no issue in the world with subtitles in these kind of scenarios being completely falsified. I will never complain about that sort of thing if it is like an artistic liberty that is being taken to improve the narrative without influencing any sort of action within the game. I am certainly not down with trying to improve the narrative by implementing magical Final Four fire twists to bail out the person you want, or adding an immunity necklace for men to bail out the person you want. I think that is totally out of line. I think fake subtitles would be zero issue for me. And similarly, just a final point I want to make about the whispering overall is I think it is just the sign of a good cast if it is something that is happening repeatedly. And I totally understand why people don't like it, and I am coming around on the idea that, like, if they do decide this is too much of an issue and they want to make a rule against it, I am ready to that is not the hill I am going to die on by any stretch. But I do think it is very much worth noting that for all the complaining that gets done about the whispering becoming a rampant thing at more tribals council than not, Dom, I think the whispering is clearly an indication of a cast who cares and who is not willing to just literally sit idly by and let things go on around them without them getting their own two cents in. I think the more whispering you see is generally going to correlate directly with the overall strength of the cast as players.
Do you think that Jeff is starting to get sick of it too? Because he was calling it like it was a horse race or like a NASCAR race or something. He was really putting his all into it with the air of someone who is a little bit regretful over exactly what he's unleashed here.
I do think it is possible that he is regretful about what he has unleashed and is not in love with everyone just standing up talking to themselves, and even he doesn't know what's going on. I think he would vastly prefer the format where everyone just remains seated and he gets to totally lead the conversation and take it wherever he wants. That said, I don't think Jeff necessarily hates this, and nor should he, as far as I'm concerned. Like, I think it is very good for the game to give the players as much time as they need to make informed decisions. And if it happens at Tribal Council, it happens at Tribal Council. And like I was just saying, as far as I'm concerned, it is a good sign for me to see an overwhelming number of players who are just not willing to let one vote go by without making sure they know what's going on. I think it is one of the best signs you could have in terms of the strength of the players within the cast.
Yeah, I would echo all of that.
Yeah, and as annoying as it may be for Jeff, I do think at least part of him is totally willing to let them do what they have to do and continue playing the game. I do think he is a fan of the game, and it may be actively fun for Jeff to get to sit there and watch. I would imagine what he hates is just being fed bullshit answer after bullshit answer.
Yeah, and in that spirit, what else do we have from the rest of Tribal here, or I guess the rest of this round as a whole?
Sure, so a couple of things just from before the votes were read that seem worth at least noting for the record, if not getting into briefly. When it's time to play the idols, Tony asks Sarah openly in front of everyone if she wants the idol to be played on her. He initially says he's going to play it, ends up taking it back after she stands up and looks around and says, no, I'm good. Jeremy also ends up not playing the 50-50 coin, which it turns out is something that gets played at the time where idols get played, so that's good to know. But also a decidedly different situation, I would say, than Sarah trying to play some mystery advantage at Jeremy and Sarah trying to play those mystery advantages at not the time when idols got played a couple of rounds ago. Just wanted to quickly touch on both of those issues, Dom, in terms of Tony and Jeremy kind of pump faking with these advantages.
Yeah, and I wonder if now that Tony expresses willingness to use it on Sarah, the fact that Sarah didn't take it, is that a sign that she doesn't have designs on voting out Tony in the near future? Because if you want to take Tony out, him having an idol is scary, potentially. And if he's willing to just give it to you, even if you're burning it, even if that leaves you with no option between the two of you, if you think, well, okay, Final Six might be the best time to take out Tony, it feels like you would want to take that off the table if you had any inclination of doing that.
Alternatively, if you want to fully boost Tony's confidence and make him think you can't possibly be gunning for him, what better way than to let him keep his idol?
Yeah.
No, it's, you are right that it is a completely valid idea if you do have designs on getting rid of Tony to, of course, want that idol out of his bag.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Anyway, so actually, the Tony and Sarah thing was far less interesting to me that just because it seems like most people are aware of Tony's idol and that he and Sarah are a thing. I'm not sure how much that exchange really impacted how anyone's going to view this upcoming round, but Jeremy pulling out, I don't think they know it's a 50-50 coin. It was happening at the time when idols would be getting played anyway. I do wonder about possible ramifications for Jeremy making it clear that he has something.
Is he going to give it back?
That is another good question. So,
we don't know.
So, hypothetically, Dom, you're Jeremy and I'm Michelle. I'm going to let it go that you did not use my 50-50 coin and have not allowed me to boost my jury resume secondhand. But I know that that coin is about to expire this round, and I certainly want it used. So I would like my coin back if that would be okay with you, Jeremy. What do you say to that?
I say, no, Michelle, but thank you for the gift. I'm use it because I've been the target for 3 rounds in a row for reasons which are still beyond my understanding, and I would like to have at least a 50-50 shot of surviving this round.
I'll use it on you, Jeremy.
Well, why don't I just use it on myself then?
Because I want to make sure that I have an accurate read when the time comes.
I trust my reads a little bit better. You know, I actually had to make reads to win my season.
So I think to break from this very fun role-playing exercise, Dom, I would, it sounds like, be more reluctant than you would to keep this coin if I were Jeremy.
Oh, so you would have used it right now, or...
No, I am saying in the timeline where I don't use it, and now I'm going to take it back to camp, and presumably Michelle will at least potentially ask to get that coin back. I would rather keep it, if obviously for myself, if she doesn't seem to care that much about getting it back. But if Michelle did really want that coin back, I would have a very, very hard time not giving it back to her. As someone who... I feel like would be immensely important for me if I'm Jeremy and I have my ideal path to victory going forward. I really want to maintain this bond with Michelle, and I would imagine even in timelines where she's using it instead of me, I'm still going to have a pretty substantial leg up on her.
Where does that bond get you if Tony and Sarah see you as this disposable game piece who, now that Kim's out of the way, you will conveniently become the next target, I'm pretty sure, and then... You know, you thought you were with Kim and Denise. Denise is the surviving member of that pair who seems like has no desire to work with you anymore. So I guess, okay, you have Michelle, but so what? Where does that leave you?
It is just more a function for me of, from Jeremy's position, I feel like the way he wins the game is getting the group on board with Tony and Sarah being the real problems and successfully eliminating them before the end. And I would imagine... In most timelines where that is happening, he is doing so feeling very good about Michelle and hoping that she is feeling very good about him. And I feel like how he handles this coin now being still in the game could be a make or break kind of situation there. Like, I do think giving the coin back to Michelle, who was just willing to give you this coin and may very easily be willing to do so again, or certainly at the very least be willing to play it on you herself the following round. Like, it does seem clear to me that Michelle very much wants to keep Jeremy in the game. And with that in mind, I feel like the number one thing I would not want to do is give her a reason to change her mind there.
It does feel like with how much attention they gave the 50-50 coin when Michelle acquired it, it's going to have some kind of impact, right? So I have to think that it is going to get played on someone who does seem to be in danger. And furthermore, does the fact that they made such a big deal of it suggest that it goes well, that it works in the favor of whoever decided to use it?
It may. And actually, something you said earlier, I meant to bring this up when you said it, but forgot. You said something about Jeremy, like which side he calls for playing the coin. I actually think one incredible hack that I don't think you would necessarily be able to get away with, but it's at least a free roll. If you find yourself on a future season of Survivor with a 50-50 coin, we see one side of it says safe, the other side of it says not safe. When you are, whoever is flipping the coin, when the time comes at Tribal Council to flip the coin, when you flip it, just scream as it's in the air, not safe, as if you are calling for it to land on not safe, because then if it comes up safe, you'll still be safe. I assume they will count it landing on safe as you being safe. And you could at least argue to the producers that you thought you were supposed to call it in the air. So if it lands on not safe, you still may get a redo.
You would get my jury vote for that alone, you know, leaving everything else aside.
I thought that, yeah, I think that would be at least worth a shot to just scream out whatever the bad side says, act like you're trying to call it on that side, and then either way, you should be okay. Not that they'll let you be safe for calling not safe and landing on not safe, but you could at least maybe get a re-flip out of that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All right, so Dom, this is going to be the end of the line for Kim Spradlin here. I will say at least a bit further than I thought she was going to be able to make it, or at the very least, she was able to navigate this time around based on what I saw in the TV episodes with substantially less kind of heat on her than I would have anticipated. What are your takeaways on Kim the second time around?
I think we saw a version of Kim that was human and showed some flaws, maybe a little bit of rust. She still played, I thought, a solid game, was somehow a big bet to win coming into this late phase, which is not what we expected. We thought Kim would maybe even have a tough time making the merge, getting any traction whatsoever. But instead, she was in there with a very real shot, I think. But there were things that were kind of puzzling, like that idol play on Denise, which mathematically I'm still trying to make sense of. And then this week, just not taking the easy vote on Sarah and maybe underestimating the threat to her own position. It felt like we saw that Kim can not be outmatched necessarily, but be matched by other players, which is not something that was a sure thing in the past.
Yeah, I do believe it is one of the more underreported. Sorry, people are certainly aware of this, but I do not believe it is listed as a caveat with nearly enough weight as is due on the just sheer ineptitude of the One World cast at large. For there were some players who I'm sure were not just actively terrible at Survivor in general, but for the most part, like, it is not impressive to me to watch super elite or experienced players just beat up on people who have no idea what they're doing and aren't even there to win in the first place. Like, it would not interest me to watch Ken Jennings beat up on idiots like me in games of Jeopardy.
I love that, by the way. Sign me up.
It doesn't impress me. And I do think that is something that has probably been at least glossed over in terms of Kim being regarded as, like, hands down the greatest Survivor player of all time. I think it is indisputable that she played one of the most dominant games of all time, but I think there is a major, major logical fallacy in saying that thus must make her...
Hold on. I don't... How is that gloss over? It is the number one automatic talking point whenever the idea of Kim being the all-time best is brought up.
Because if it were not glossed over, people, I don't think, would be comfortable talking about Kim in those kind of historic, kind of rarefied air terms. And at the same time, though, Dom, like, everything I have ever, ever, ever seen out of Kim Spradlin over 1 3/4 seasons of Survivor against extremely varied degrees of competition, and certainly any statement I have ever heard her make as just Kim Spradlin the person rather than Kim Spradlin the TV character, without a doubt it at all, I am absolutely certain that if anyone belongs in the list of like all-time great social players of Survivor, no doubt about it, Kim Spradlin is in the top tier out of anyone who has ever played in the physical sense. I mean, she is the number one winner of immunity necklaces by any woman who has ever played Survivor, and she did it in not even two full seasons. It is merely the strategic element that I now have more questions about, and totally hand up on this. Had she not played the idol for Denise at that round at Final Nine, I don't even know how many questions I would have in this capacity as things pertain to Kim Spradlin. But like, that to me is a pretty glaring mark against her, and maybe the only glaring mark against Kim. But I do think it is worth considering the possible overhype in that capacity alone that may have been in play over the years for Kim Spradlin. Like, I do think just her social abilities by themselves were enough to win her a season of historically bad players, and I am by no stretch saying Kim Spradlin is like a fraud or didn't deserve to win or wouldn't have won against, but I do think that while I think it's at least even arguable that her game this time around on the whole was far more impressive than her winning game in Survivor One World, I am coming away from this with at least some questions about Kim Spradlin that did not really exist for me before.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. So there goes Kim, at least for now. Certainly going to be in the mix, I'm sure, to be one of the front runners to win that reentry challenge if she's able to get enough fire tokens to balance out the advantages that the other six people, six people just bought themselves multiple advantages this week on Edge of Extinction, and Kim just didn't have that opportunity. I'm sure she would have much rather, knowing how this is going to go, be voted out at the merge and be in there with a better chance. But anyway, Dom, I think that is at least going to do it for me on episode 12 regular stuff. We will be quickly diving into the edit zone. So for anyone averse to edit specific discussion, now would be the time to tune out. He is, of course, on Twitter at DomHRV. I am on Twitter at Colin Stone. I never say this, but you can also find Dom on Instagram at DomHRV as well. And the only reason I bring up is quarantine is getting me to the point where I may even go for Instagram soon. So watch this space for future Instagram plugs from me.
What do you have to Instagram? You're not going outside. Unless it's just going to be thirst traps, which I think is solidly in your range.
No, it is. I just want to have something else to scroll through. Of course, I'm not going to be posting anything on Instagram. I have nothing to take pictures of.
Coward.
Yeah. Anyway, Dom, I think that is going to do it for the main section. Let us now hit the edit zone.
You are listening to the Dom and Colin Edit Zone.
Mike Holloway,
Michelle Ken,
Brad Culpepper,
Rob and Sandra.
You are listening to the Dom and Colin
Edit Zone.
What are you doing?
Tune out now.
All right, so here we are back in the edit zone. Dom, hitting the home stretch here. Not too many candidates, at least from my perspective, to be getting through this week. Let me ask, is Tony, who was once again all over the place this episode, still number one for you? Are you still feeling best about that?
I think so. Although Tony's domination over the past few weeks, for me, it hasn't led to done training people. It's led to, I guess, untraining people. Because I think basically everyone still has at least a theoretical shot now. Because with Tony being so in the forefront of everything and being built up as not just the biggest and best player of the season, but if he continues in this vein, the best winner of all time, leaving aside the fact that, yeah, maybe you get that by default by winning the season. If anyone takes him down, that's all they need. It doesn't matter what's come previously for the past 11 episodes. Recency bias, as we've seen with the first Edge of Extinction, is all that matters. In that case, it was all that could matter. But here, if someone takes Tony down at the final hurdle, that might be enough. That's a resume by itself. You don't need to put anything else on it. And in the minds of most viewers, if Tony is the person who is going to and ought to win, and you take him down, maybe you inherit that mantle. So Denise, let's say, who's had a pretty quiet few weeks and unclear what people think of her, if she can engineer Tony's ouster, instantly Denise vaults to the top of the power rankings for me. And the same goes for basically anyone who is left looking good in the wake of Tony leaving. So, you know, Michelle went from surefire front runner, would take Michelle against the field, to slipping down the thing. If she has any involvement at all and gets to talk about voting Tony out, then she is still number one with the bullet for me. Who else? Like even Ben or Nick. I would go as far to say that
I'm not going that far.
If Nick blindsides Tony, I think Nick is a front runner. But the question is not who blindsides Tony, it's who is given credit for blindsiding Tony. But I think that actually opens a lot of doors. And even something so far as a repeat of the first Edge of Extinction, where if someone comes back in and they are the one to maybe pull a Chris Underwood and go up against Tony in fire, or they get to like idle him out, or I don't know what it would be. But, you know, I think it's very much in the mix. So like Yule could just hop back into the game, beat Tony in fire and win the game, and it would make sense to me, even if you couldn't really have seen it coming.
Danny Boatwright, 1% club, that's the ticket right there. I feel like certainly we're at the point where, like, if Tony makes it to the end, he is going to win, and I do agree that if he does not make it to the end, his elimination will potentially play a great role in determining who ends up winning the season, like who is at least seen as being the one responsible for that, and certainly as far as the TV episodes are concerned, whoever is portrayed as being responsible for that is going to gain a tremendous amount of equity. I would guess that he is going to win in pretty much any timeline where he makes the finals, especially, by the way, I did note, I didn't pick this up until rewatching the episode, but I do think it is not nothing that Tony, after this tribal council, gets the Boston Rob stamp of approval, where they cut to Boston Rob in the jury box whispering to someone and getting subtitled saying, "Wow, Tony is such a boss." And for Boston Rob to be Boston Rob to be describing anyone else, all right, sorry, Dom, as a boss, it's not funny, apparently. It's, I think, a noteworthy situation,
Is it all too much? Is a thing. Like, is it too obvious? Is there any doubt left that someone could be Tony if we get to that point? I guess if Tony continues to spit on his kids and to do grimy stuff like that, then he's creating that doubt for himself. But is this too much of a coronation? Like, does there need to be some element of subtlety to it for this to stick the landing?
Totally. I think it is at least within the realm of possibility. I just think it's super unlikely. I think overwhelmingly, if Tony makes it to the end, he will be the winner. I do think it is within the realm of possibility that he could lose to Sarah, Michelle, or maybe even an Edge returner. I really don't see him losing to Nick, Jeremy, Denise, Ben. It is totally within the realm of possibility. When we have another 4+ hours to go of the end game coverage here before final tribal council, absolutely Tony could play his way out either strategically or socially, and have this all come crashing down on him without question. But based on the way I feel like we are meant to be feeling about Tony at this hour, it really seems to me like he is going to be a pretty big front runner if he is able to make it all the way to the end. Now, again, he is doing so much scheming and side scheming and sub scheming that this could very easily blow up in his face at any given moment. It just, I'm certainly feeling like at this hour, Tony is getting his way often enough and being shown in a positive and controlling kind of self-aware light regularly enough to be the front runner for me. I am absolutely, though, not ruling out the possibility of Sarah or Michelle being the one who, like, takes him, or even an Edge returner being the one who, like, takes him down, and that is pretty much all it takes to get the jury on your side on day 38 or day 39. Juries are extraordinarily biased by the last few days, I would say.
What do you think about Sarah? Where does she fit in for you?
Very clear number two for me at this point. I would not describe this as necessarily a bad week in terms of Sarah content. Even seeing her like screaming at Tony and talking about how her whole game is trashed or whatever, I do think Sarah is definitely still worthy of quite a bit of consideration here. And I, while not seeing anything along the same lines as like last week's fashion show for Sarah, that I think is definitely something as far as a winner edit is concerned that would be worth taking note of. Nothing really stood out to me in that respect this week, but it definitely still seems like Sarah is very visible, very involved, looking at least likable enough for the average viewer, and we are seeing a lot of focus on the smaller things she does well. So yeah, Sarah very much still in the mix for me. What about you?
And then so Sarah for me, I think it just feels like something is missing, right? It feels like this is building towards just some tragic downfall at the hands of Tony, which we're going to see epic recriminations for at Final Tribal.
I agree that that's more likely than Sarah winning at this. I think not only it not working out with Tony, but being actively betrayed by Tony, I do think is probably the most likely scenario at this point.
Yeah, she is being made into a big character, but I think the reason for that is we need her to be a big character so that when Tony betrays her, we understand the full gravity of it more so than she's in the finals and we need to flesh her out so that all of that makes sense.
I mean, maybe we are being set up for, and I should potentially be more open to this as a timeline. We've seen so much about Tony and Sarah and how good they feel about each other, and Tony fucked her over once and she forgave him. If this does end in him just like totally screwing her over again, and she's already warned him, like, do whatever you want as long as it's not at my expense, but if you come at me, we're done forever, not just within the game, but in real life too. Maybe this is setting up, hey, here's this crazy wild ride Tony has been on, but I mean, Sarah herself has had confessionals about how the thing Tony fails to really take into full consideration is the social game, and that could come back to burn him. It is very possible, I guess, now that I am really thinking about the various timelines, that Sarah is essentially going to explain to us why Tony loses.
And be one of the reasons why Tony loses.
Right, right, right. The storyline with Sarah, I mean, is going to be why we have this not go Tony's way potentially at the end of the game.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And in that timeline, you know, if Sarah is on the jury having been burned and Tony is in the main game unable to get her back on his good side come Final Tribal Council time or after that, it could very easily be the case, Dom, that Michelle is, you know, the person mm-hmm. we spent so long talking about during the entire pre-merge is indeed the one who comes in and picks up the pieces. And, you know, I've been coming down and down and down on Michelle for the last few weeks, it feels like, but it was flagged up to me, and I do feel like I was overlooking the obvious reality. Shout out to AJ Van Gilder, official accountant of the podcast, for focusing me on this once again. While Michelle has been having kind of underwhelming weeks lately, I still feel extremely good about Michelle's chances in a finals situation against any combination of, and these are all people I think I could easily see as losing finalists, Nick, Ben, Denise, and potentially Adam, who has been getting a lot of focus over on not just while he was in the main game, but is once again being flagged up and kind of clowned upon on Edge of Extinction. Like, if he gets back in and is a losing finalist, that would not blow me away. And I think that is at least four people that if Michelle is in the finals against any combo of them, all of whom I could see at least conceivably having some to plenty of finals equity, I think we're looking at Michelle winning.
Yeah. So if that wouldn't blow you away, do you think it's the most likely outcome, or is it just, you know, a corner case potentially?
I may, you know what I said, Sarah, it's a lot closer than I
mean, Adam returning, by the way, with all that would come with that.
Sorry. in thinking through, I'm trying to decide which of, Sarah or Michelle is my number two here. Because I feel like Sarah getting the big kill on Tony would virtually guarantee Sarah's going to be the winner of this season. Or probably the same could be said of Michelle too, though. So, God, I think I may actually be at the point where it is more likely for me now, after last week having Sarah as my very clear number two, I may have already said Michelle was the number three, clear number three for me earlier in this very edit zone. You may have talked me into, albeit inadvertently, moving Michelle up to number two. I just keep coming up with more people she could conceivably beat in the end and continue talking myself more into the idea that Sarah is going to get knifed here near the end game.
How big is the gap then between Tony and Michelle in your estimation?
Not as big as it seems to be for pretty much anyone else that I have been hearing talk about the edit, but it is, I am going to go with, let's say I will take Tony at 55%, Michelle at 25%, Sarah at 15%, and the edge returner at 5%. I don't even know if the edge returner is even 5% for me, but we'll call it that just because I don't want to redo the math in my head.
All right. Who is that edge returner? Call your shot.
I still feel best about Parvati or Natalie in terms of if someone's going to go from the edge and win the game. In terms of just edge returner in the dark, I still feel like Adam is in the mix. I feel like Sophie has got to be in the mix. And who could ever count out Kim or Tyson? I do not feel comfortable making one definitive edge returner pick at this point. I would say, again, if it's someone who has to go on to win, I would say give me Tyson, Parvati, or Natalie. But in terms of just raw edge returner, who's it going to be? I would, at this point, only really be ruling out Amber, Ethan, and probably Boston Rob. And probably okay. Wendell. I don't see Wendell being a part of the story again.
Sure. I'm happy hanging in the down training around Wendell. But other than that, it does seem like there's all to play for, maybe.
Yeah. Any other? Where are you on just the relative likelihood for Tony, Sarah, Michelle? I don't need exact percentages that add up to 100, but just roughly, where are you on that?
I would say, honestly, something like Tony 40, and then 40, 45, and then Michelle in like the 30 range potentially, and Sarah lagging a little bit behind.
Okay. Yeah. I may. When you initially asked me, that was kind of my impulse, is that I don't even know if Tony has that big of a lead on the rest of the field. I was just really struggling to give other people non-zero equity. But yeah, I think we're on roughly the same page there, at least for now. But I'm sure this time next week, Dom, we're going to be swapping people all over the place back and forth again, and potentially multiple times within the edit zone itself. So can't wait to see how all of that plays out. I don't believe I have anything else to get to this week. Do you have anything else?
No, I'm good.
All right. I think that is going to then do it for us. Thank you guys, of course, who have made it this far into the podcast. Now would be the time to Venmo me that $4,000 you owe me for listening this far. So go ahead and do that. And we will be talking to you guys very soon. Take care, everybody.